Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Host Tucker Perkins recorded this special episode from Reuters Energy Transition North America in Houston, where he talked to business leaders and other experts at the forefront of driving climate innovation. Now, here's Tucker.
I've been looking forward to this conversation on Path to Zero because we get to hear from one of the nation's leading experts on energy markets and the electric grid. Ed Herz was appointed as an inaugural energy fellow at the University of Houston. He consults, he lectures, writes on energy markets, the environment, investment, finance, corporate governance, and ESG. Ed, we're so happy to have you today here.
My pleasure.
We've just got so much to talk to, and so let's get into it. We're starting here at the Reuters Energy Transition for North America. We're talking about Biden's goals for net zero. How realistic are those goals?
You know, I think the goals can be attained. You know, it's just going to be at a price.
And how about in the time frame? I mean, Biden, depending on some things are 2030, some things are 2035. I look out now, and I don't see anything possible by 2030.
It's extraordinarily ambitious, and you know, it's always difficult to make a stake in the ground type of statement. Yeah, we're not going to get there. We're going to make a lot of progress towards getting to net zero. But again, it just costs money. Now, in 2008, we had the Waxman-Markey bill that did not get through. Senator Kennedy passed away before it could go in. And, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act is what Waxman-Markey started out to be and then what it became. We are shoveling huge sums of money towards low-carbon solutions. Some of these will work. You know, I know there's a lot of frustration in the market and with Wall Street right now because, you know, they're looking for some sort of material improvements. You know, this takes time, and it's going to take a little bit of time for the investment decision to be made. We've seen, for example, in the renewable fuel side, sustainable aviation fuel, renewable diesel, an awful lot of projects announced, but they're running into just a huge number of problems. One of my business partners built the very first RDSAF plant in Geismar, Louisiana, the one that was done with Tyson Foods and 13 years ago. And
that's REG?
REG now owns it, and that's the keystone plant for that company.
That's our primary source of renewable propane today.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I don't know that the listeners need to know what happened with the chicken fat beforehand, but we now know it's put to good use.
Well, let's kind of take those segments little by little. So, and then let's start with maybe the one that's in the news every day right now, offshore wind. Certainly a lot of pushback right now, even on previously announced projects, generally around interest rates. We're seeing, you know, really a pushback from offshore wind. Do you think offshore wind will be a significant contributor to zero grid?
Well, it certainly is in Europe. And, you know, keep in mind those wind turbines in the North Sea are mounted on deep water spar rigs. Those came right out of the oil patch. Edward Everett Horton III was a guy who had all the patents. He passed away a couple of years ago, but he had repurposed these for offshore wind. Yeah, the wind blows with a little more strength in the North Sea, a little more regularly. What we found here in the United States is offshore wind is perhaps less productive. You know, one of my good friends had spent a dozen years or more trying to build a wind farm offshore Massachusetts, and that just didn't happen. There's the
around the economics.
Yeah, the Block Island installation. I think it's 5 or 6 turbine units. They've been installed, but you know, there's some significant operational issues. New Jersey, Orsted just wrote down its investment and is abandoning its direction. And then here in Texas, we had two offshore wind leases that received no bids a few months ago. So the economics are tight, and part of this is looking at the way these local electricity markets are going. I believe Dominion is building one offshore Virginia, but they've set up a purchaser and they can lock in a margin. And indeed, when we look at the solar farms and the wind farms as they were built here in Texas, most of those had power purchase agreements in place. For example, the city of Houston entered into a number of these, and they tout that they have 100% renewable electricity. And of course, you know, electrons an electron, it doesn't know who mom or dad was. And they execute financial swaps and substantive physical swaps. An electron that goes into the grid out in West Texas is just as good as one that comes from the parish coal plant here in Fort Bend County. With the advent of wind and solar, and the way these particular markets, such as ERCOT, are structured, the low marginal cost producer bids in. And since wind and solar don't have a cost of fuel, they can bid in less than the natural gas, the coal, and the nukes when there is an abundance of supply in excess of what the demand would be. So, for example, you know, today, a temperate day across most of Texas, we're not going to see a big spike in the power demand. We have more than enough generation to operate, and so prices will stay down throughout most of the day. When we hit the summer, hot days, and due to the way ERCOT really messed up its market this year, you know, prices spiked to $5,000 a megawatt hour. That's $5 a kilowatt hour for those at home. You know, everybody made out like bandits. But the way the market is structured, if you and I were to go add four or five coal plants or four or five natural gas plants or even four or five nuclear power plants, we would make sure that the average price stayed down all the time. And, you know, as since we have to get our money from Wall Street, Wall Street's not going to allow us to build new fossil fuel power plants in Texas simply because that would make sure they don't get a rate of return. The trajectory for the Texas grid, because of the great growth in wind and exponential growth in solar, is to go to these low marginal cost producers of power. The South Texas project has got 1,100 workers. It's got roughly 2.5 gigawatts of power generated by the two nuclear reactors there. A 1.2 gigawatt natural gas combined cycle turbine unit probably has 80 to 100 workers. The big Samson solar farm that's going in just north of Dallas on some 30,000 acres is going to generate 1.3 gigs with, you know, full sunlight. It's going to have 12 full-time workers and a herd of sheep. So in terms of operating cost, you know, apart from whatever they have to pay the landowner, that's going to be the low-cost provider. And the public has lurched and driven in this direction because they are uncomfortable and unhappy with the vagaries of volatile fuel costs, such as we saw last year. Natural gas prices went from around $3 per MCF up to $9 per MCF because we quickly had to shunt a lot into LNG production. For those utilities in the Northeast, you know, for example, Maine, where they get their marginal fuel for electricity production from LNG, they wound up paying the same price for electricity as Europeans did. You know, $75 per MCF LNG is really expensive to produce electricity.
Yeah, because they're not even getting domestic LNG, right? They're getting...
It's not domestic or whatever. You know, once an LNG tanker hits the hits the ocean. I mean, goodness, these guys were turning them around, for 10 cents out in the middle of the Atlantic. It's a fungible market.
Right.
And then Maine, well, for example, New York, we looked at this last night at class. You know, what is the marginal driving resource? And for New York last night, it was dual fuel. They were burning heating oil over natural gas.
Because of cost?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So let's go back to the 30,000 acres of solar field. To me, it doesn't sound like a really relevant energy-dense solution. I mean, we can't to get 1 gigawatt, a little bit over 1 gigawatt, to use up 30,000 acres, we could do that with a conventional power plant on 200 acres, right?
Right.
Taking that aside, you have the intermittency problem. And energy storage isn't ready yet. You agree?
It hasn't caught up. I mean, it's very expensive. And, for example, if we look at the wind farms, on average, and again, this is a game of averages. If we look at a wind farm that's on average 20 to 25% productive, to replace a legacy power plant, let's say it's 25% productive, then you'd need to build it 4 times. To match up one for one with the legacy power plant you're displacing, but keep in mind then, you know, there are certain times of day you know the wind is not going to blow, so we need batteries. Well, how much battery do we need? So maybe that's 10 times the amount, and now we have to build up the wind to be able to not only provide power to the grid but provide the power to charge those batteries for the, you know, extended discharge that comes twice a day. We're just not there yet.
And as you think
it's
about,
something we can do. There's no question.
Think about energy storage, and I mean, I'm quick this because I think about it all the time. And there's maybe some pump storage. There's talk about this or that battery system. Tesla's trying to do a few utility scale, but at the end of the day, there really is not a utility scale solution out there. You agree?
There can be. Some of the technologies that are being developed might get that way. The Safe Hydrogen Venture, which came out of one of the thermoelectron portfolio companies, has a hydrogen magnesium slurry that they've used for electricity storage. They can keep the price below 10 cents a kilowatt hour. It hasn't been applied at scale yet. There are some of these synthetic leaf technologies which are being developed, splitting off the hydrogen, basically using that as some sort of storage. But these are a few years down the road.
Yeah.
And the analogy I like to use is natural gas and natural gas production in the United States. For many years, through the 60s and 70s, we looked at natural gas as a declining resource. And in fact, we passed laws that prohibited the use of natural gas for something so pedestrian as producing electricity. That led to this huge growth in coal-fired power plants in the 70s and 80s. That plus, of course, Three Mile Island. And George Mitchell, of course, had been working to perfect fracking for 40, 50 years. In 1970 and 1971, the United States used a couple of nuclear warheads to try fracking in the shales in the Colorado area. It didn't work. And so Mitchell, with his high-pressure hydraulic fracturing that he put into place in 97, 98, really opened the window. And suddenly we were able to access the gas in these tight formations. And by 2012, our math is that had driven down the price of natural gas by so much that the net benefit to consumers was over $100 billion a year.
Wow.
And then now if we extend hydraulic fracturing out, it's approximately $160 billion a year. If we add in the fact that we've used hydraulic fracturing to access tight oil, we've gone from producing a little less than 6 million barrels of oil a day to producing as much as 13 million barrels of oil a day. That's lessened and improved our trade accounts. So, you know, hydraulic fracturing, for all the hand-wringing, has saved Americans more than $1 trillion over the last dozen years. And most of that has gone to electricity cost reduction, and a significant amount has gone to a better balance of payments because we're not having to import as much oil.
Now we start talking, particularly around natural gas and propane, now we begin to think about domestic security as well, which is certainly a very positive thing for natural gas.
It's something we've been writing about for a number of years. So our paper, Crude Oil Imports and National Security, remains valid to this day. The United States doesn't have any import restrictions at the moment, doesn't have any export restrictions either. So we're open to the market. Mm-hmm. You know, Nobel winner Bill Nordhaus pointed out that a price change in Saudi Arabia ripples right through the market instantly up to North Dakota and over to the Permian. So our concern with that is, with 18 million barrels a day going through the Strait of Hormuz, that a blockade or even a partial blockade that knocks a couple of million barrels a day off the market will lead to a huge price spike. In fact, the Russians in February of 22 said that if they took their 7 million barrels a day off of the global market, that we would see a price spike to $300 a barrel in the crude oil prices, and that honestly came right from our paper.
Interesting. So let's talk about one other energy, nuclear. Do we get there without nuclear?
I don't know. It's just announced in Houston that Dow Chemical is partnering with a firm to build what will be the first of the pebble bed reactors. The uranium contained within ceramic balls that they essentially roll around on the floor, if you will, to get to the optimal heat output. This is something that the scientists, DOE, have been talking about since the early 80s. And so this will be a real test. It's real money going behind it. Dow Chemical is in a situation of being really concerned because of the volatility on the Texas grid. Not only the volatility of electricity, but the volatility in the natural gas grid. And so the addition of these power plants, you know, for their own use is a great way to reduce their risk. When the Texas grid went down in 2021, you know, some of these chemical plants, petrochemical plants, they weren't back online for 15 to 18 months afterwards because things just literally got gummed up in the pipes. Doesn't matter if the grid's offline for 10 minutes or 10 hours. They're out of operation.
So let's talk about that grid, because my recollection is that you were one of the few people that predicted Winter Storm Uri's impact on the electric grid long before Winter Storm Uri happened. And you've probably studied it as much as anybody post-event. Talk to us about what happened and how that's not going to happen again.
Well, we hope it's not going to happen again. You know, keep in mind that last week the CEO of ERCOT, the Public Utility Commission, pointed out that under several plausible scenarios, including another Winter Storm Uri event, that the opportunity for rolling blackouts in Texas was better than 1 in 7. You know, frankly, here we are in the 21st century, and our grid operator is talking about rolling blackouts, you know, just like you would in Islamabad, right, or Ankara, or any developing nation. This is, you know, for the capital of energy, a hell of an indictment. So in 1989, there was a massive polar vortex that descended across Texas. And this was in the old days with the vertically consolidated, integrated utilities. Houston Lighting and Power own its own generators, transmission lines, local distribution company, and they sent you the bill. Today we would call that a microgrid. And the North American Electric Reliability Council issued a 12-page after-action report. In 2011, we had a polar vortex that descended over the northern part of Texas. It resulted in a death, at least one, and extended blackouts. Put the medical center in Dallas out of commission for days. The after-action review was more than 300 pages. The Texas government did nothing. Now, the change between 89 and 2011 was the so-called deregulation of the Texas grid, or as I like to say, the partial deregulation. I mean, it'd be the equivalent of my walking out and saying, I've deregulated Interstate 10. You can drive any speed you want. Speed limit's gone. It's deregulated. Or you're in Austin. I've deregulated I-35. You can drive as fast as you want. And, you know, here we are. Yeah. 8:30 in the morning, how fast do you think you're going to get from north to south Austin on 35?
Pretty slow.
So it was just partially deregulated, and it was deregulated in the sense of separating the generating units out from the transmission, which remained cost-based regulated, separated out from the local distribution companies, which remained cost-based regulated, such as CenterPoint in Houston. And the retail electricity providers, I liken to the guys who sell roses on every corner. They don't really have any assets. They're just trading. So the reason Texas went down this path is they looked at the vertically integrated utilities and said, my God, we're paying for all these generators even when they're not operating, which is true. And the utilities built their generation portfolio to service peak demand, which would come in the middle of the summer. And because Texas is unable to grab in electricity from other markets, that was a decision made in 1938. And so
it probably will never change.
You know, and there's no reason why it should. I mean, frankly, if Texas can't take care of its own problems, what good is it? And you know, what grid would want to connect to Texas? We'd take them down, you know, at the peak problem, if you will. We were short 52,000 megawatts of power. At most, the Western Interconnect had 7,000 megawatts. And MISO and the Southwest Power Pool were both dragging as much as they could from PJM. There was just not enough. Right. It just doesn't happen. I mean, California has figured this out. The horrible summer of 2020, where they were, of course, relying upon their neighbors to provide power when they ran short, well, they realized there's, you know, in financial terms, we talk about systemic risk. The systemic risk was that heat dome extended across California, Oregon, Washington, Arizona, Nevada, all of California's trading partners in electricity, and they didn't have anything left to spare.
They were all subject to the same issue.
And so, you know, here in Texas, the guys at Enron went to Governor Bush and said, hey, look, we've got 1,000 generating units on this grid, and on average, we only run 650 across the year, and we pay for these other 350. Why should we do that? Why don't we just set it so that we only pay for performance? And so Texas went down the road of the electricity-only market. And so if, for example, we're looking at the Houston Astros, if they were compensated on an electricity-only basis, only those guys taking the field during the game get paid. The guys on the bench don't get paid. And of course, throughout the course of a year, some of them might go hungry. Well, you know, that's what happened here. And there was no investment incentive to build new power plants just to make sure the price stayed down. And Texas adopted this model of linear programming, or locational marginal pricing, as they call it, to handle the grid when things get tight. It's not a competitive situation where somebody's bidding and asking to provide power. This is something run by a computer algorithm. the same sort of linear programming model that the old Soviet Union used in the 60s and 70s to manage the economy. And as everybody who has looked at this, it's kind of a broad statement, but I've spent my career here. Mm-hmm. You know, linear programming models don't account for a return on capital.
Right.
And they have a real difficult time accounting for weather. For example, this past year, Southwest Airlines had its optimization scheduling model all blown apart because there was a huge fog bank in San Diego and a winter storm in Chicago.
Now, but with so many people looking at that grid, depending on that grid, you have economists and legislators and just smart people, yet they don't make changes in the system that perpetuates that type of grid. Why is that?
That's a mystery, isn't it?
It's because consumers who vote for people demand the lowest price. But we've lost sight of the fact that we have to have a reliable grid as well.
This is the 21st century, and you know, the testimony in the state house, the state capitol, following Uri, indicated that we were probably 5 minutes away from a complete de-energizing of the grid, a black start situation. Texas, for some reason, has really never addressed this.
In that condition, a black start would have created a sheer blackout for days,
months.
Right? Oh, months.
Actually, months.
Okay.
So CEO Magnus said it'd be months before we could get this back up and running. So think about that, 26 million Texans without electricity. Now, what goes with that? Water service, healthcare. We won't be able to get fuel out of the gasoline stations. Food deliveries.
Refrigeration.
Society goes to heck in a hurry. And you know, for those of us who've been along the Gulf Coast, we've seen Katrina's aftermath in New Orleans. The social fabric is very fragile. It breaks down. And you know, in Texas, where there's, you know, any number of firearms per citizen, legal or illegal, it would not be a pretty place. Yeah. You know, how many Berlin airlifts would it take to keep Texas in the 21st century?
Yeah, I mean, it's indescribable.
There'd be no cell phone.
Indescribable.
And you know, the legislature and the governor seem to think that's acceptable.
Well, let's talk about, you wrote a piece in Forbes, and we'll talk about some of your work and where it's best presented, but the future Texas grid and how to get there. How do you see the grid, say, a decade from now?
Well, with no change in the trajectory, and certainly we haven't seen any changes coming out of the legislature, we're going to see continued growth in the renewable side, the wind and solar, because of the incentives and the fact that really they have no cost of fuel. They're going to bid in and build across the grid, and they will displace the coal plants. Those are the next to go.
Right.
These are big, dirty, expensive to operate.
You don't see carbon capture for coal.
It's not practical.
Yeah.
I mean, the one unit that's operating the Petronova installation down at the on unit number 8 of the Parrish plant for NRG, that's also the unit that exploded over a year and a half ago and has not been put back into operation. The technology is there, but the efficacy is not.
Again, it gets back to economics.
Well, yeah, the coal-fired power plants in Texas average 50 years in age. The natural gas-fired plants average 30 years in age. And the owners of the coal plants have written them off. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're keeping them alive to kind of help with the transition and take advantage of these peak pricing opportunities that ERCOT has been handing out left and right.
Let's have a little fun. And I can't wait for your answer to this. We deal with magic, right? We're going to hand you a magic wand and give you one wish to change one thing in the next year, so lots of ones, that you think would have the biggest impact in your field around this energy transformation. How would you use your magic wand?
Fusion. We've
solves every problem.
Looking at this for a long time, the one of my dear friends who's passed away, joined Argonne National Labs in the early 70s. He told us, he said, at the time I was told that fusion's just 20 years away.
In the 70s.
And then
Microsoft has bought fusion-based power in the future.
And then we, Rich Mattis was the U.S. representative to the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, ITER. And you know, the real challenge with fusion is being able to contain it. We don't have any materials known to mankind that can hold a fusion. I mean, that's the sun. That's a big fusion reaction, and you know, it gets hot here, and we're millions of miles away. And so how do we manage that? In fact, solar power, solar panels are fusion collection. That's a big challenge. How do we get there?
Well, so I know you write prolifically. We talked about being an oil and gas investor. I know you've been in Forbes. Where can our people that want to follow your writings and kind of learn a little bit more about what's in your head, where can they find more about you?
Well, the easiest thing is my website, edhurs.com. And we post the articles there.
So when you write research for Forbes or The Economist or Oil and Gas Investor, it's there.
Yep.
Edhurs.com.
Yep.
H-I-R-S.
Yeah, like his, like his and hers.
All right, that's the last question. I know you've been all over. We love to plant a tree in honor of you for the time you spent with us on this. You can pick a national forest anywhere you want it to be. Where would that national forest be?
El Yunque in Puerto Rico.
Wow. Don't know it.
It's the only national forest and only rainforest national forest in within the U.S. boundary.
Well, we will look forward to finding it and putting a tree there.
It's Ed a lovely Hurst, place.
Thank you so much. Your experience, your views, it's been wonderful to have them today on Path to Zero. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to path2zero@propane.com.